WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. Our next guest on today's show about space exploration is Alan Shepard, the first American in space. In 1961, Alan Shepard rode the Mercury space capsule to an altitude of 115 miles. 10 years later, after the nearly disastrous flight of Apollo 13 aborted its mission and barely got its astronauts home, Shepard commanded the next mission to the moon, Apollo 14. In between those two space flights, Shepard was grounded for medical reasons, but helped direct the space program as chief of NASA's astronaut office. 25 years ago, when Terry Gross interviewed Alan Shepard about his then-new book called Moonshot, she asked him about his first space flight back in 1961. That trip was so brief, he didn't have much time to experiment with weightlessness.
My flight was only 16 minutes. We did have about 5.5 minutes of weightlessness, and the thing which we tried to cram into that 5.5 minutes had to do primarily with my ability to actually control the spacecraft, actually fly it like an airplane. Because we knew that so much of the early days of space depended upon the abilities of a pilot, not only under primary conditions with no casualties, no failures, but also to practice for situations where the pilot would have to take over in order to bring it back in safely. So most of the 5.5 minutes were devoted to my actually controlling the spacecraft and reporting how I was doing and that sort of thing.
How were you doing?
I did great, of course.
I mean, how did it feel to control the spacecraft while being weightless?
Well, it was a tremendous exhilaration, of course, at being up there in the first place. Also, the second place, the fact that everything was going well. And then lastly, the fact that I flew it exactly as I was supposed to fly it.
Was it what you most wanted, to be that first American in space?
Oh, I think all of us wanted that. We were a very highly competitive group to start with. We were all test pilots. We knew that only one of the seven was going to get to go first. And, everybody wanted to go.
During a launch pad test of Apollo 1, there was a fire and three astronauts were killed, Gus Grissom, Edward White, and Roger Chaffee. What happened?
Well, I think... Let me generalize first, and I think what the situation was at that time was that we had flown successful Mercury missions, we had flown successful Gemini missions. There was a sense of pride and accomplishment, but there was also perhaps a little false sense of security, maybe a little bit too much pride, maybe a little bit overconfidence, if you will. And desire, obviously, to get on with the moon landing to try to meet President Kennedy's schedule. And we talk about this in the book, pointing out the fact that Grissom, who was designated to be the commander of that flight, was not at all pleased with some of the things he found in the manufacturing and the testing processes. And even though he protested rather strenuously, somehow the things that needed to be fixed didn't get fixed in time. And, of course, it is a tragedy, in fact, that Gus was killed in the fire along with Ed White and Roger Chaffee. But on the other hand, at this stage in the game, although obviously it's traumatic to lose your buddies, all of a sudden, the NASA people and the aerospace contractor people said, "Hey, you know, this thing really wasn't put together as well as it could have been. Maybe we were in too much of a hurry. There was some redesign. There was a hiatus. Trying to find out exactly what had happened, and with this redesign, with this reassessment, we created a spacecraft that was obviously so much better than the Apollo 1 spacecraft had been. Again, it was really as a result of that fire that all of a sudden the organization said, yeah, folks, we really aren't doing as well as we could have been. And again, that resulted in a really fine program all in all.
You write in your book that you felt you couldn't get too emotional about it and that you had to take the attitude, well, it's part of the business. Did you have to take that attitude for the benefit of the other men who were waiting to be launched?
I think that all of us in those days, basically being test pilots, felt that that was the way things go in our business. I mean, it wasn't the first of our friends that had been killed. A lot of contemporaries over the years of test flying had been lost, killed for one reason or another. So it wasn't the first time that it happened within our fraternity of test pilots. And as I say, it was emotional, but it's one of those things, well, you've got to find out what happened, correct it, and let's get on with the job, folks.
You were grounded for several years because of an inner ear problem, and then you were able to be cured through a surgical process that surprised everybody by working and working very well. So then you got to go to the moon, which you'd long wanted to do. Now, before you landed on the moon, you lost your radar, and Mission Control was thinking you should abort, but you didn't. Why didn't you want to abort?
You got to be kidding. I mean, after going 230,000 miles, you're going to worry about a little radar? Come on.
A little radar? I mean, what was it like for you to maneuver the ship without radar? What was blinded without radar?
Well, actually, let me just back up a little bit. We had a problem earlier on the way out where we couldn't dock with a lunar module. That was traumatic. We finally got that resolved, and off we went with permission to land. We started down. Well, we didn't actually start down, but we ran the computer down open loop, and it refused to go down because there was a bad switch. And so that was point number two. Either one of those would have ruined the mission. So we were pretty objectively oriented when we came to the point where during the descent, one is not looking at the moon. You're looking away from the surface. And in order to be allowed to continue below around 13,000 feet or so, one has to have an update from landing radar. We were down around 20,000, somewhere along in there, and we were not getting updated on the radar. And we were being told from the ground that the radar wasn't working. We said, thank you very much. We understand the radar is not working. We can tell that. And they reminded us that we didn't have landing radar in by 13,000 feet. We said, yeah, we remember all that stuff. And it was getting pretty tense and pretty close. Finally, some bright young guy in the control center said, hey, this landing radar is working, but it's locked on infinity. Have them recycle, pull a circuit breaker and see what happens. So we pulled the circuit breaker, and sure enough, the landing radar came in with a matter of, maybe a half a minute or so to spare. We go on down and land, and we're shutting off the switches. And my co-pilot, Ed Mitchell, said to me, Alan, what were you going to do if the landing radar was not in at 13,000 feet? And I said, Ed, you will never know.
Well, what did you plan on doing?
I think I would have gone down, at least to the point where we could have pitched over and taken a look at the surface, because I had great, great faith in our ability to land from almost any off-nominal case. We practiced that in the simulator for hours and hours and hours, and so I had a feeling that if I could just see it and realize I wasn't running into any mountains or anything, that I probably would have gone down.
What surprised you most about how the surface of the moon looked?
I don't think we had any surprises about the actual surface of the moon, about the barrenness. We had looked at pictures of our landing site taken by previous missions. We had worked with the models that were made from those pictures. We knew the general configuration of where the craters were supposed to be. We knew the objective of Cone Crater, which was the one we climbed up the side of to get rock samples. There weren't any surprises there. The surprise I had was standing on the surface after we'd been there for a few minutes, having a chance to rest a little bit and looking up at the Earth for the first time. Now, you have to look up because that's where it is, and the sky is totally black, and here you have a planet which is four times the size of the moon as we look at it from the Earth. And then you also have a color. You have a blue oceans and the brown land masses, the brown continents, and you can see ice on the ice caps on the North Pole and so on. And just an absolute incredible view. And then you say, that looks a little small to me. It looks like it does have limits. It's a little fragile. You know, down here we think it's infinite. We don't worry about resources. Up there you're saying, gosh, you know, it's a shame those folks down there can't get along together and think about trying to conserve, to save what limited resources they have. And it was just very, very emotional. I actually shed a couple of tears looking up at the Earth and having those feelings.
Well, Alan Shepard, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure, Terry.
Alan Shepard speaking to Terry Gross in 1994. He died in 1998 at age 74.